Wardrop 4. How many people, how many crew were in your aircraft?
Three. There's a pilot, of course, and the observer sat side by side in the front, and the gun layer at the rear. And the gun layer, he had two platforms, one higher and one lower. He had three Lewis guns, one at the bottom, refined back underneath the tail, and two at the top. And the observer had two Lewis guns in the front cockpit, and of course they're also responsible for the bomb dropping equipment. And the method of dropping the bombs, of course, is to lay much prone, and he had five pushes, like bell pushes or light pushes, and there's five lights, two red, two green, and one white. The white obviously being the center one was to guide the pilot, whatever the observer wanted him to do. Two green meant, of course, veer to the right and so on. And that method, of course, the pilot was able to see exactly what the observer wanted and got trying to get him lined up on the target. And that's where our previous training came in about bomb dropping, way back to the Eastchurch days of getting absolutely on target. The only difference is, of course, one had to calculate the height and the wind and drift and so on, you see, and speed the machine, which is all done, of course, by angles, more or less. But we had 14 bombs, and invariably most of us used to drop, say, six or seven, and come round for a second run, and so, of course, straggle the bombs, and we found that the most successful way of getting a hit. We wouldn't say seven bombs would hit the target at the same time. We didn't mind if even one out of seven hit the vital target. Well, we're quite satisfied. But you caused an explosion, you see. That was our technique, as it were.
Was there any this being the first time you'd seen a Handley Page when you went to Coudekerque, did you have any familiarisation or training flights in the aircraft?
As the aircraft as such, of course, was quite simple. I mean, everything was more or less automatic, and engineers were responsible for the engines and so on as a crew. But to familiarise ourselves, or me myself anyway, with the surrounding country, I went with Flight Commander Brackley on a flight, which is on August the 13th, I think, they call my records, to familiarise myself with the surrounding country. So that I'd always get to know when I was getting towards home, as it were, from a raid and so on, and picking up the various landmarks. And we travelled as far as Ferns and then returned to Dunkirk and circling between these two points several times to making sure that the surrounding country, I got them in mind, got in roads and landmarks and that sort of thing. And we found it very interesting, very instructive. And of course, as years went on, as months went on afterwards, I found it very, very useful to memorize all this and get to be used to the countryside around their own aerodrome.
Did you do that in the daylight or at night time?
Both, really. We had to do it in daytime and night, but night time mostly. Because all our work was at night, really. But as regard to day work, of course, if we went testing a machine or if we had engine trouble, we'd always have it put right and test the machine again before a raid. If we had trouble with any of the guns, we used to go out to the sea and fire those and make sure that was all right, and so on. But that was all done, all that sort of work was done in the daytime. And any special landing or height tests or flight tests, that's all done in the daytime.
Was it very easy to see at night time?
Yeah, but providing the visibility was right, and when I say that, with not too much mist or cloud, but on a clear night, yes. On a ordinary clear night with no moon, then the roads would appear a darkish colour. There were forests and woods, of course, very black, and rivers are very dark grey. And on a moonlight night, the roads would appear almost a light grey, almost a white. The water or rain, rivers and so forth become almost bluish, wonderful, and even railway lines would shine up more as silvery in a moonlight night, on a moonlight night. And of course, obviously, forests and woods became very, very clearly defined. So we always welcome on a moonlight night. Another interesting scene, one could say, or sight, was on a moonlight night, you see, passing over the clouds, a double shadow of yourself. You could see the shadow on the cloud itself, and you see the shadow on the ground, if you're low enough down, you see, and the cloud's low enough down. There's rather interest in that, to see two of yourself kind of gliding along. But it's quite simple to find these various targets, of course. We used to obviously study the maps and photographs and that sort of thing in the country, of course.
Were there any navigational aids?
No, except of, as I say, just maps and the countryside, and also distances, as it were, from the coastline. And we used to, as far as I was concerned anyway, to make the coastline of the Belgian coastline more or less my datum line, as it were, for everything, both going to Brugge, obviously, and Bruges and Ghent and so on. And as regards a return trip always, I got to a stage where, discretion the better part of valour, I found over many months in the service, that after a raid we used to, if we could, make out to sea, whether we just to veered on near Holland, it's just too bad, but go out to sea and stop out there about 10 miles out and then come in again at probably Curiekirk or by Calais or Dunkirk and come into our drome. It's far easier than coming across Belgium, we shut up all the way from one anti-aircraft gun or searchlight, so that's what we used to do, if we could. But it depended, of course, where we went to. If we went to Denny Westrom, right south of Ghent, well, because we couldn't do that, it's too many miles away.
Did the Dutch object if you accidentally strayed, or deliberately strayed in their airspace?
Well, I'm afraid they did object, because they just fired at us, such as it was, but were they ever intended to hit us, I wouldn't know, but I didn't think they could have ever hit us, really, but they did certainly objected, and they fired at us in no uncertain way, but who were we to argue? I mean, we were there to get back to our room, you see.
How about visibility inside the aircraft? Were you able to see your maps?
Oh, yes.
So
oh, yes.
You have little lights?
Little lights at all, yes. It's bluish lights, actually. And we had torches, of course. But, of course, bear in mind that though we could see easily from the air, even two people lighting matches, light a cigarette, it's rather astounding, but you could on a dark night. We were to be careful we didn't show ourselves up the other way round, because we light up in the air, as you know, so easy to discern. So we had to be very, very careful. We should know torches.
When organising a raid, how much notice would you have that one was on?
Well, it might get an hour, that's all, you see, because we two meet in what we call a mapping office. And the commander, who was in charge, of course, it got to a stage, Commander Brackley was in charge of our squadron. He would then brief us. We'd know from our briefing orders our crew and our machine and what size bombs we'd carry. And then he would, of course, give us our orders. It might be if you're called to go to Bruges on the docks, or Zeebrugge, roving commission, moving trains, active aerodromes, might be any of those. Well, having got the orders, then you confer, of course, with the other two members of the crew. You sit down and get the maps out and look at the photographs we might have in the mapping office, which we have plenty, of course, and we study and how we're going to approach it. Depending on which number of machine you're away, the first machine away is tested what we call visibility. He will give the signal either to continue raiding or not. And having done that, then you make up your mind which way you're going, depending on the target. Whether you're going overland and make a straight run for the target, or whether you're going out to sea and coming in, it depended. And from the mapping office, you simply go back to our billet and dress and go straight to the machine. We never allowed or never written to talk to anybody, because the whole thing was so secret that no one knew where we were going, not even our own crew knew where we were going. And that's enough. It was for obvious reasons. I mean, one just didn't want anybody else to know.
Did you have to turn your pockets out or anything?
Well, we just told that all the way through. We never used to carry much at all, except our name, you see, and the squadron number. And that's all we allowed. So if we got captured, that's all we used to give.
You had instructions about what to do.
Oh, yes, I think there's about 27 items, I might tell you, which has instructions, what not to do, what to do, and so on. And these you have to try and memorise, of course. But
what was there as far as you... was there any sort of organisation which would get you out of occupied territory if you landed there?
Well, I didn't know of any, actually, but the only experience of personal experience I had, of course, I mentioned in my log that we were brought down from Bruges in No Man's Land, and the Belgians came out of the dugouts to save us. Really, they did save us. I thought they were Germans at first, and I made an awful mistake. Really made a mistake of my life. I just pulled my revolver into this man's side, and I thought he was German because he wore white trousers. And lucky enough, he wasn't. He was Belgian. He took us to a dugout, and they wouldn't believe that we were British. They insisted they were not British, you see. And we couldn't convince we were British. We showed them our uniform and everything, but they wouldn't believe it. And now they said they could speak English. Well, we can either speak Flemish, really, they were speaking. And none of the three of us were very good linguists anyway, just smattering of French, but they couldn't understand, they kept on saying, and all that sort of thing. And after about 2 hours, they gave us some sandwiches and beer, and just playing a lot of smoke, of course. And after about 2 hours, one man said to me, "Do you come from London?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Do you know the Strand?" And I said, "Yes." And I then began to think that I said he couldn't speak English, and I must be dreaming. And you know, your mind was such a confused state by this time. I mean, having been on the raid itself, being brought in from the No Man's Land, and sitting there for nearly 2 solid hours, not making out they could speak English, full of sandwiches and probably had a couple of beers, and I began to wonder what the deuce was going on. You see, and suddenly I said to this man, "Well, I thought you said you couldn't speak English." He said, "I couldn't 2 hours ago." He said, "I can now." He said, "We verified." He said, "Who you are and where you come from, you see?" He said, "Well, going back," he said, "the Strand, do you know the black hole?" I said, "Oh, yes, rather. I've been down there many times." He said, "I used to be a waiter there." I said, "Well, I never." And he told us then that a car would come for us next daybreak from the squadron, you see. And he was one of the people that looked after us in this dugout. That's my only experience I've ever had of being rescued. It was a very good rescue as far as I was concerned, believe me. The next morning, our car did come. We told our driver not to go beyond a certain point because the Germans would bomb it, would shell him. And because he, like all people in the air service, of course, they poo-pooed the idea. We just put a long bow to him and said, "Oh, it's a lot of nonsense." And every decided, though, he's going to drive up to turn round. And we told him he'd go by himself if he was going to do that, so he went by himself. He didn't go very far because he got a shell over the top of him, and because he got scared, threw himself out the car and dropped down a ditch, and because we had to shout to him, "For God's sake, get back in the car, we want the car back here, you see." And once we did get in the car, he didn't stop. I shouldn't think he did less than 60 or 70 miles an hour all the way from Newport to Cudikirk. He fried the life out of all of us. We just, honestly, I never had some nervous right in my life. I thought I could go on an aeroplane, but my job, he did. Around the corners, and oh God, he didn't stop. And the poor chap, he got sent back to London, England rather than the finish. He lost his nerve altogether. Frightened him, you see.
When you were describing the briefing for raids and the sort of targets you were being given, were you ever told to make a whole city or a whole town your target, or was it always precision bombing?
Only certain objects, like certain precision bombing, docks and so forth. And in fact, we were really severely, very severely reprimanded if we found we even bombed a house, even by mistake or design, but we certainly reprimanded over it. Oh no, we had specific objects like docks, railway stations, ports, of course, all kinds of buggy, locked gates, canals, aerodromes, you see. But where we visited a target, and they had a hospital, which we could see, of course, the Red Cross, which to refrain even from going for that particular target. We're told it's not worth it, not worth the risk, you see. Now, we very definitely had those different instructions, and we tried to adhere to it, obviously. But when it came to bombing their aerodromes, we didn't pull any punches, because we'd pretend to land and all kinds of things. I got all kinds of tricks I got up to, but it didn't worry me. But, on one occasion, they even put the lights up for me. And I probably gave them what I got left in the machine. That's all there's to it. That's as easy as that, you see.
How did you set about tricking the enemy like this on an airfield, for example?
Well, putting lights on, for instance. Putting navigation lights on. From blissful glass, you see.
And entering their landing pattern.
Oh, yes. Mm. You see, they've come the lights and said, instead of landing, of course, you drop what you had. I did it on one occasion, Mark. Didn't attempt to the gate on the same place, but I thought I shouldn't do that sort of thing. But
why shouldn't you?
Well, you know, it's one of those things that could be dangerous, you see. Take an awful unnecessary risk, in other words. You're not supposed to take an unnecessary risk as far as you're concerned, the machine, you see.
They might have shot at the lights first and found out which side
out. Of course, you would, yes. Especially if you had none of their machines out, you see. You'd only do it if you had an idea they're active. In other words, you don't. I wouldn't have never attempted if an aerodrome was dormant. Occasionally I knew they were active because I'd seen the lights go on and off during the time I was coming over, you see. So I knew they were active, they got their machines out. So I knew they're in the air somewhere, either right in England. So I thought I'd just try it on, you see.
Did your own airfield have landing lights?
Oh, yes. Yes.
So that you had that as a guide to
bring back. Oh, yes, bring them back. Oh, yes, which is a signal, you see.